12, to answer questions from members of the City Council and the public. During Muir's remarks, which lasted more than an hour, he acknowledged that the victim needs to be our priority, and that the police department had to find ways to challenge our officers to be better communicators with sexual assault victims. After Muir finished, Barrett walked up to the microphone and stood before the 50 or 60 people seated in the council chambers. "My name is Carrie Barrett," she began in a tremulous voice, "and I was sexually assaulted in September." She'd decided the time had come to publicly identify herself as one of the victims who had been denied justice by the Missoula Police and the Missoula County Attorney's Office. For the next several minutes, she explained some of the issues she had both with the police and the prosecutors. Her harshest criticism was directed at Prosecutor Kirsten Pabst for testifying at the university court hearing on behalf of Calvin Smith. The fact that she would show up to a university hearing on her own accord, voluntarily, to defend a rapist and keep a sexual predator in our community is extremely alarming to me. As the event was drawing to a close, Missoula City Councilman Mike O'Haron stated that he was particularly and profoundly impressed by Barrett's willingness to share her experience and express her concerns in a public forum. "It's made my week," O'Haron told her. "Your courage and your fortitude and your wherewithal to step up to that mic, it's affected me, and I appreciate you doing that. Way to go." Not everyone in the room was pleased by Carrie Barrett's candor, however. When the hearing was over, as she was preparing to leave, Barrett was approached by Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg, the man who ran the prosecutor's office and acted as Kirsten Papp's boss. "He was visibly angry," Barrett recalled, and told her, "I want to talk to you." "Okay," Barrett replied, undaunted. "I want to talk to you, too." "What you said up there about Kirsten Papps isn't true," Van Valkenburg sputtered, according to Barrett. "She was subpoenaed. She was required to testify."
"Subpoenaed?" Barrett said. "By who?
It was a school hearing. You know better than anybody that the university doesn't have the power to subpoena witnesses."
"She was subpoenaed by the defendant and his lawyer," Van Valkenburg said.
Barrett pointed out that Calvin Smith's lawyer, Josh Van de Wettering, had also asked Detective Connie Bruckner to appear at the university hearing, but Bruckner's boss, Police Chief Mark Muir, had refused to let her testify. "So don't try to tell me Pabst was forced to go to that hearing," Barrett said to Van Valkenburg. "It was her own decision to testify."
"Okay," Van Valkenburg conceded. "Technically, I guess she wasn't required to appear at the hearing. But she felt she had a moral duty to testify."
"She had a moral duty to keep a rapist in our community?" Barrett demanded.
"Whoa,"
Van Valkenburg said with a flushed face, according to Barrett. "You're talking as if you know all the details of this case. I can assure you that there are many things you're not aware of." Van Valkenburg had no idea that Carrie Barrett had testified at Calvin Smith's university court hearing, and that she had a much more accurate understanding of what Smith did to Caitlin Kelly than did either Pabst or Van Valkenburg.
"Actually, we're talking about one of my very good friends," Barrett said. "So I know a lot more about the case than you think I do. And one of the things I know is that Kirsten Pabst, who is supposed to prosecute rapists, instead went out of her way to defend a rapist in an effort to keep him enrolled at the university and on the streets of Missoula. She was simply acting on her belief that he shouldn't be expelled for a crime he didn't commit," Van Valkenburg protested.
"The fact that Pabst believed Smith's testimony over Kelly's," Barrett retorted, "proves my point that your office assumes victims are lying." By this time, Barrett recounted, Van Valkenburg was shouting and other people in the room were staring at us, wondering what the hell was going on. So I told him, I know, it's all about those bells. They can't be unrung." Then Barrett spun away and walked out of the room. Carrie Barrett's comments at the hearing that night made a lasting impression on both Fred Van Valkenburg and Kirsten Pabst, however. 5 months later, when the Missoula rape scandal was approaching full boil, Pabst was still so perturbed that she let fly with a rant on her personal blog that blamed Carrie Barrett, Caitlin Kelly, and Gwen Florio, without actually naming them, for manufacturing an unwarranted media frenzy. On Tuesday, June 19th, Pabst posted a bizarre screed titled, "Why Reporters Should Be Elected Officials."
Lawyers who violate the rules of professional responsibility answer to the Montana Supreme Court's Commission on Practice, she wrote, and police officers who break the rules are likewise held accountable. But reporters who act unethically are accountable to nobody. Specifically, Pabst explained, I refer to the Missoulians' campaign to make the people of Missoula believe we are in the midst of a sexual crisis, to frighten people into buying papers, lots of papers. Without getting into inappropriate detail, I assure you that the foundation for the string of sexual scandal articles is not based in fact. The unfortunate reality is that the officials in charge of setting the record straight have their hands tied by the Montana Confidential Criminal Justice Information Act. When the police and prosecutors decline to file charges against a suspect, all of the facts are legally sealed. You wouldn't want the world to think you sell drugs to schoolchildren just because your crazy neighbor is pissed because your dog barks too much. Or worse, you wouldn't want to be labeled a child molester because your vindictive ex said you hurt your own child. It happens with more frequency than we would like to believe. So why can the Missoulian publish allegations labeling legally innocent people as sexual offenders because a couple of disgruntled young adults who get to remain anonymous spin a good story to a reporter too lazy to check the facts? The answer is that reporters answer to no one except their corporate owners. Carrie Barrett had a different opinion of the Missoulian's coverage. Barrett pointed out that the number of rapists who avoid prosecution is vastly greater than the number of innocent men who are wrongly charged with rape. Prosecutors like Pabst, who decline to pursue rape cases, Barrett suggested, should receive more scrutiny in the news media, not less, and Gwen Florio deserved to be praised for her courageous reporting about Missoula's rape problem. Florio has suffered so much abuse, Barrett said, but she was instrumental in bringing this to the attention of the public. If she hadn't reported it, it would have been swept under the rug, and nothing would change. Chapter 10. Zeke Adams sexually assaulted Carrie Barrett, she alleged, in September 2011, near the beginning of her senior year at the University of Montana. For several months thereafter, until she graduated and left Montana, Barrett would occasionally encounter Adams on the UM campus, causing her to recoil in disgust and wonder how many other women he'd assaulted previously and would assault in the future. In late 2013, 2 years after Caitlin Kelly was raped by Calvin Smith, she told me that she couldn't help thinking about women Smith might have subsequently raped as well. Once a rapist, always a rapist, Kelly said. He's going to do it again if he hasn't already. Research by David Lisak suggests that Barrett's and Kelly's concerns about their assailants are not unfounded. In the 1980s, when Lisak was studying rape as a graduate student at Duke University, almost all of the research at the time had been done on men in prison who had been convicted of raping strangers. It showed an alarming tendency among incarcerated rapists to commit multiple acts of sexual violence. But this research didn't match the circumstances we were encountering when we interviewed rape victims, Lisak told me, almost all of whom had been sexually assaulted by people they knew. It's been estimated that approximately 85% of all rapes are in fact committed by assailants who are acquainted in some way with their victims, and that only a small percentage of these non-stranger rapes result in the successful prosecution of the rapist. So Lisak devised a study that would provide insights into offenders who'd managed to avoid both punishment and scrutiny, a population that accounted for the overwhelming majority of rapists. Specifically, he designed his study to reveal whether these undetected rapists, like their incarcerated counterparts, showed a propensity to rape more than once, and whether they were likely to commit other types of interpersonal violence. The study, titled Repeat Rape and Multiple Offending Among Undetected Rapists, co-authored by Paul M. Miller and published in 2002, added significantly to the understanding of men who rape. Lisak and Miller examined a random sample of 1,882 men, all of whom were students at the University of Massachusetts Boston, between 1991 and 1998. Their average age was 24. Of these 1,882 students, 120 individuals, 6.4% of the sample, were identified as rapists, which wasn't a surprising proportion. But 76 of the 120, 63% of the undetected student rapists, amounting to 4% of the overall sample, turned out to be repeat offenders who were collectively responsible for at least 439 rapes, an average of nearly 6 assaults per rapist. A very small number of men in the population, in other words, had raped a great many women with utter impunity. Lisak's study also revealed something equally disturbing. These same 76 individuals were also responsible for 49 sexual assaults that didn't rise to the level of rape, 277 acts of sexual abuse against children, 66 acts of physical abuse against children, and 214 acts of battery against intimate partners. This relative handful of male students, as Lisak put it, had each on average left 14 victims in their wake, and the number of assaults was almost certainly underreported. Upon looking at his data for the first time, David Lisak was shocked. He thought he must have made a mistake somewhere. He knew from studying earlier research done on men in prison that most violent crime is committed by a small number of individuals in any given community, he told me. But in our survey, we were looking at college students. Initially, I had trouble thinking of them as criminals. When Lisak went back and re-examined his data, however, it held up. Moreover, a similar study published in 2009 by Stephanie K. McWhorter, which examined 1,149 Navy recruits who'd never been convicted of sexual assault, replicated Lisak's findings. 144 of the recruits, 13%, turned out to be undetected rapists, and 71% of these 144 rapists were repeat offenders. An average of 6.3 rapes or attempted rapes could be attributed to each of them. Of the 865 rapes and attempted rapes reported in McWhorter's study, 95% of the assaults were committed by just 96 individuals. As Lisak had reported, a small number of indiscernible offenders, only 8.4% of the population studied, were responsible for a staggering number of rapes. It should be noted that all of the subjects in the studies by Lisak and McWhorter participated voluntarily, and that none of the undetected rapists identified by the researchers considered themselves rapists. When recruiting his subjects, Lisak told them he was studying childhood experiences and adult functioning, and promised them confidentiality. Participants agreed to complete a packet of questionnaires that asked such things as, "Have you ever had sexual intercourse with someone, even though they did not want to, because they were too intoxicated on alcohol or drugs, to resist your sexual advances, for example, removing their clothes? And, have you ever had oral sex with an adult when they didn't want to because you used or threatened to use physical force, twisting their arm, holding them down, etc., if they didn't cooperate?" Although every question used explicit language to describe very specific acts, Lisak was careful never to use such words as rape or assault. Any participant who answered yes to one of the questions on the questionnaire was subsequently interviewed and asked follow-up questions. When interviewing his subjects, Lisak said, "I made sure I didn't in any way suggest that I was judging them or that I was horrified by what they were telling me. As a researcher, I'm prohibited from saying anything to them that would alter their view of themselves. It's not like I can debrief them at the end and say, 'By the way, what you just described to me is rape.'" The participants in the study had no qualms about being research subjects, Lisak told me, because they share this common idea that a rapist is a guy in a ski mask wielding a knife who drags women into the bushes. But these undetected rapists don't wear masks or wield knives or drag women into the bushes, so they had absolutely no sense of themselves as rapists and were only too happy to talk about their sexual behaviors. Most of the student rapists interviewed by Lisak were regarded by their peers as nice guys who would never rape anyone and regarded themselves the same way. "The serial rapists, hidden in plain sight among us," Lisak explained, "harbor all the usual myths and misconceptions about rape. Additionally, we now have data showing they are more narcissistic than average, so they're caught up in their own worldview. They lack the ability to see what they do from the perspective of their victims. It's not like they've spent any time thinking about what it would be like to be passed out and wake up to someone raping you. It's not like they've ever asked themselves, how would I feel if I fell asleep, someone climbed on top of me and penetrated me with his erect penis? Rapists don't do that. They exist in their own world, and in their world there is often a tremendous sense of entitlement. To illustrate a rapist's worldview, Lisak opened his laptop and played a video he'd christened The Frank Tape. It's a harrowing reenactment of an unedited 5-minute segment of an interview he did with a student rapist, performed by an actor who has precisely mimicked the rapist's delivery and callous self-regard. The following segment, which I've abridged, begins with Frank telling Lisak, "We have parties every weekend." He goes on, "That's what my fraternity was known for. We'd invite a bunch of girls, lay out a bunch of kegs or whatever we were drinking that night, and everyone would just get plastered. We'd be on the lookout for the good-looking girls, especially the freshmen, the really young ones. They were the easiest. It's like they didn't know the ropes, like they were easy prey. And they wouldn't know anything about drinking or how much alcohol they could handle, so, you know, they wouldn't know anything about our techniques. We'd invite them to the party, make it seem like it was a real honor, like we didn't just invite any girl, which I guess in a way is true. Then we'd get them drinking right away. We'd have all those kegs. But we always had some kind of punch also. We'd make it with a real sweet juice and just pour in all kinds of alcohol. The girls wouldn't know what hit them. They'd be guzzling it, you know, because they were freshmen, kind of nervous. The naive ones were the easiest, and they'd be the ones we'd target. We'd all be scouting for targets during the week. We'd pick them out and work them over during the week, and then get them all psyched up to come to one of our famous parties. You basically had to have an instinct for it. I had this girl staked out. I'd picked her out in one of my classes. I was watching for her, and the minute she walked into the door of the party, I was on her. We started drinking together, and I could tell she was nervous because she was drinking that stuff so fast. It was some kind of punch we'd made, you know, the usual thing. She started to get plastered in just a few minutes, so I started making my moves on her. I kind of leaned in close, got my arm around her, and then at the right moment, I kissed her. The usual kind of stuff. And after a while, I asked her if she wanted to go up to my room, you know, get away from the noise, and she came right away. Actually, it wasn't my room. We always had several rooms designated before the party that were all prepped for this. She was really woozy by this time, so I brought up another drink, you know, and sat her down on one of the beds, sat down next to her, and pretty soon I just made my move. I don't remember exactly what I did first. I probably, you know, leaned her down on the bed, started working on her clothes, feeling her up. I started working her blouse off. At some point, she started saying things like, "I don't want to do this right away," or something like that. I just kept working on her clothes, and she started squirming. But that actually helped, because her blouse came off easier, and I kind of leaned on her, kept feeling her up to get her more into it. She tried to push me off, so I pushed her back down. It pissed me off that she played along the whole way and then decided to squirm out of it like that at the end. I mean, she was so plastered that she probably didn't know what was going on anyway. I don't know, maybe that's why she started pushing on me. But, you know, I just kept leaning on her, pulling off her clothes, and at some point she stopped squirming. I don't know, maybe she passed out. Her eyes were closed. Lisak asked Frank, "What happened?" "I fucked her," Frank answered. "Did you have to lean on her or hold her down when you did it?" "Yeah, I had my arm across her chest like this, you know, that's how I did it." As he spoke, Frank demonstrated how he placed his forearm against the victim's sternum, near the base of her neck, and leaned on it to hold her down. "Was she squirming?" Lisak inquired. "Yeah, she was squirming," Frank said, "but not as much anymore." "What happened afterwards?" "I got dressed and went back to the party." "What did she do?" Lisak asked. "She left," Frank answered. Lisak's interview with Frank was typical of the interviews he did with other rapists. In a part of the interview not included, Lisak told me, Frank actually described 2 other rapes he did under almost exactly the same circumstances, except the 2 other victims were unconscious from alcohol at the time, and Frank had no idea that what he was describing to me were acts of rape. "Predators like Frank get away with it over and over," Lisak explained, "because most of us are in denial. We're disinclined to believe that someone who's an attentive student or a congenial athlete could also be a serial rapist. But Frank and his ilk are sexual predators who do incalculable harm to their victims, and it's crucial for police officers, prosecutors, and campus administrators to regard them as such. The problem is, most officials who are responsible for holding rapists accountable don't consider guys like Frank to be dangerous criminals, and even when they do, too many of them are reluctant to file charges and prosecute perpetrators of acquaintance rape because they're convinced that the odds of convicting acquaintance rapists are slim. Too slim to justify the immense investment of time, money, and emotional capital required to mount a full-scale rape prosecution. Prosecutors justify this reluctance to prosecute by pointing out that their sworn duty is to act in the best interest of the state, not to serve as personal attorneys for victims of rape or any other crime. David Lisak considers this rationale both self-defeating and short-sighted. He argues that failing to aggressively prosecute rapists like Frank doesn't merely harm the many victims of acquaintance rape, it also does tangible harm to the general public. When men like Frank repeatedly rape and get away with it, Lisak said, their behavior becomes entrenched. It's obsessive. And once this pattern is established, it tends not to be something that just stops. Sexual predators are constantly practicing, constantly testing the boundaries of potential victims. You know how when you talk to an experienced salesperson and after a couple of beers they'll tell you how you can learn to read people? How you can learn techniques for closing the sale? Sexual predators are pretty much doing the same thing. It's not that all of them are geniuses, but they're constantly honing their skills, and they get very good at it. They get much better at it than most of us are at detecting it and resisting it. Lisak acknowledged that prosecuting rapists like Frank is difficult. He said, however, I absolutely disagree that such cases are impossible to prosecute. There are prosecutors across the country who have been very successful in taking them on, but it takes a lot of expertise and a willingness to approach non-stranger rapes in a whole new way. It also requires that prosecutors understand that a relatively small number of rapists do most of the raping. Statistically, the odds that any given rape was committed by a serial offender are around 90%, Lisak said. The research is clear on this. The foremost issue for police and prosecutors should be that you have a predator out there. By reporting this rape, the victim is giving you an opportunity to put this guy away. If you decline to pursue the case because the victim was drunk or has a history of promiscuity or whatever, the offender is almost certainly going to keep raping other women. We need cops and prosecutors who get it that nice guys like Frank are serious criminals. David Lisak argues that the police need to investigate rape suspects with the same diligence they use to investigate narcotics kingpins and perpetrators of organized crime. The focus of the investigation shouldn't simply be this one seemingly isolated rape, he explained. It should be, who is this suspect? Who can tell us what he's really like? Who are the other women he may have raped? Detectives need to subpoena email accounts, look into the suspect's Facebook friends. They need to really dig. Police officers who approach rape cases in this way are likely to turn up other victims and other crimes. And when prosecutors have evidence of multiple victims, it becomes much harder for defense attorneys to attack any single victim's credibility. The time-honored rape defense that so often results in acquittal. Part 3. Unwanted Attention. During my trip to Missoula, I was shocked by how many UM students found it inconceivable that an illustrious football player, a quarterback, no less, would ever rape anyone. Those guys can sleep with anyone they want, people told me over and over again. For example, everyone agrees that in the words of a man I meet under the disconcertingly fluorescent lighting at a divey sports bar called Missoula Club, football players in particular don't need to rape to get fucked. This is despite the fact that at least 6 of the school's football players were involved in the cases currently being investigated by the federal probe. Katie J.M. Baker, University of Montana quarterback charged with rape. Jezebel, August 1, 2012. Chapter 11. When Beau Donaldson was arrested on January 6, 2012, for raping Allison Huguet, it was the lead story in the next day's edition of the Missoulian. For the next 6 months, Donaldson's crime and other sexual assaults by University of Montana students were an increasingly frequent subject covered by the Montana news media. On January 8th, the paper ran a piece describing Carrie Barrett's and Caitlin Kelly's frustration over the refusal by the Missoula police and the county attorney's office to file charges against their alleged assailants. On January 11th, the Missoulian published a guest column by Mark Muir, the chief of police, defending his actions. "Rape cases," he wrote, "are a significant challenge. Proving the case beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury is even more difficult." On January 15, 2012, an article by Missoulian reporter Michael Moore revealed that a UM student had belatedly come forward to report being sexually assaulted in February 2011, when she was a freshman. She had been discovered unconscious in the snow outside her dormitory in the middle of the night, with her pants and underwear pulled down to her ankles. Bruises covered much of her body. A hand had pressed down so hard on her mouth and face that an imprint was still visible, Moore reported. Rug burns bloodied her knees. The previous evening, she'd had too much to drink, and while walking home with a friend, stopped at a coffee shop. Someone bought her a cup of coffee, and after she drank it, she saw a group of young men pointing at her and laughing. "One of them mouthed the word roofies at me," she told Moore. Frightened, she ran out of the cafe, after which she remembered little until she was found sprawled on the frozen ground of the UM campus outside Jesse Hall and was taken to her room. The next morning, when she went to the University Health Center, she said, "They treated me like I was just some drunk girl. All the questions were like, 'Well, are you sure you just didn't fall down?'" A subsequent forensic exam at the First Step Sexual Assault Clinic revealed that she had been raped. "I know my case probably won't be solved," the victim said, "but I wanted people to know what happened." She decided to tell her story to the newspaper in the hope that it would motivate the university and city officials to start taking Missoula's rape problem seriously. "This is a bad thing that's going on," she told Moore, "and we all need to do something to try to fix it." On January 17, 2012, 2 days after Michael Moore's article was published, UM President Royce Engstrom addressed the rash of sexual assaults at a public forum attended by 125 Missoulians, including Chief Muir, Mayor John Engen, and state legislators. "I want you to know that we take this very seriously," Engstrom assured the audience. During a question and answer session following his remarks, a local social worker named Ian White told Engstrom that he believed the main cause of the problem was the Grizz football team. "I respectfully disagree," Engstrom countered, although earlier in the evening he'd acknowledged that a small number of university athletes were responsible for part of the problem. In a confidential memo sent to UM staff, however, Engstrom had essentially agreed with White by writing that university investigations indicated a disproportionate association between the sexual assault crisis and patterns of behavior of a number of student athletes. 4 weeks previously, Engstrom had assigned former Montana Supreme Court Justice Diane Bars to conduct an investigation into the university's apparent outbreak of rapes. On January 31, 2012, she submitted what came to be known as the Bars Report. "The reports of sexual assaults on the UM campus now require immediate action," she wrote. "Due to the number of incidents added since December, the investigation needs to be ongoing." She was proved correct on February 17th when UM students learned of two more sexual assaults in their midst via an email blast sent to the entire campus warning of a possible threat to the community. Shortly after 2 a.m. on February 10th, a male student from Saudi Arabia had encountered a female student on the UM campus and offered to give her a ride to her residence hall. But instead of proceeding directly to her dormitory, he said that first he needed to pick up something from his room at International House, a university-owned residence hall for foreign students. When they arrived, the male student poured her a cocktail and urged her to drink it. Immediately, she began to feel queasy and lose control of her body, at which point the man began kissing her against her will. The last thing she remembers is trying to escape through a window. Friends later found her unconscious and took her to her room. Later that same night, approximately an hour after the aforementioned victim fled from the Saudi student's room, he drove past a different female student as she was walking to her dormitory, steered his car to the curb, and offered to give her a ride. Because she knew him, she accepted. After she got in the vehicle, the Saudi student told her the same thing he'd said to his earlier victim. He needed to stop by International House on the way to her dorm in order to pick something up. As reported by Dylan Cato in the Montana Kaiman, an independent student-run newspaper published by the university, when the two students got to International House, the man talked her into coming up to his room, then poured each of them a drink. The woman soon began to feel nauseated and vomited. Her next memory, she told Cato, was of the male student lying on top of her, both of them naked. His breath smelled terribly. I remembered the weight of him on my chest. She said she was having trouble moving and still felt ill. She said the man then grabbed a condom and proceeded to rape her, and she yelled at him to let her go. Eventually, the man fell asleep, and the effects of her spiked cocktail dissipated, allowing the woman to flee and make it back to her residence hall. Both assaults took place in the hours before dawn on Friday, February 10th, 2012. That afternoon, the first victim, who wasn't raped, reported her encounter with the foreign student to the UM Office of Public Safety, and the campus police notified Dean Charles Couture about it on February 14th. Additionally, campus cops apparently brought the perpetrator in for questioning at some point and charged him with a misdemeanor for providing alcohol to the first victim. The second victim, who was raped, didn't initially report the incident to the university police or the Missoula police, so UM public safety officers didn't know about the second, more serious assault when they first talked to the foreign student. Over the weekend, nevertheless, the first victim learned about the rape of the second victim through the campus grapevine. On February 14th, 2012, the first victim, who had been assaulted but not raped, received a phone call from Dean Couture to schedule an interview with her on February 17th. When she showed up for the meeting, she surprised Couture by bringing along the second victim, who had been raped. Until that moment, Couture was unaware that there even was a second victim. According to Dylan Cato's article, Couture assured both women that he would summon the student who'd allegedly assaulted them to his office to be interviewed and would possibly take away his visa and expel him from the university. In response to the rape, as required by a 1990 federal law known as the Cleary Act, at 4:51 p.m. on February 17th, the university disseminated the mass email warning of possible dangerous conditions on or near its campus. University policy obligated Dean Couture to notify the foreign student that he was being investigated for the alleged rape of the second victim, which Couture did that afternoon with a phone call. Couture didn't ask the student to surrender his passport, however, because he had no legal authority to do that. Nor did Couture call the Missoula police to let them know about the rape. Instead, the police and other city officials learned about the rape from the email alert, which did not make them happy. Approximately 90 minutes after the email blast went out, Mayor Engen sent an email to President Engstrom and Jim Foley, the UM Vice President for External Relations, in which Engen said, "It appears that two alleged sexual assaults are linked to a single suspect whom the Office of Public Safety had in custody and cited on a misdemeanor minor in possession charge. Both of the assaults appear to have happened off campus and should have been immediately reported to the Missoula Police Department. I hope the Dean of Students feels some obligation to report the crimes to us so we may engage in an appropriate, professional criminal investigation. While we understand that there are implications for the suspect based on the student code of conduct, that investigation ought to take a back seat to a criminal investigation of an alleged sexual assault." Engen was wrong about where the assaults occurred. They actually took place on university property, but that was immaterial. Just 3 months earlier, the university had signed a memorandum of understanding with the city, granting the Missoula Police Department jurisdiction over all felony crimes committed on the UM campus. This agreement, however, did not trump the university's purported obligation to respect the privacy rights of the victim, in the opinion of UM legal counsel David Aronofsky. Frankly, if a victim says, "I don't want this brought to the police," he told the Missoulians Gwen Florio. We're going to honor that. Aronofsky's reluctance to involve the police may also have been related to the refusal of the Missoula County Attorney's Office to file charges in the Carrie Barrett and Caitlin Kelly cases. During the university court hearing for Kelly, Aronofsky became aware that both Barrett and Kelly believed that their treatment by the Missoula Police Department and prosecutor Kirsten Pabst had been demeaning and counterproductive. Both women said they would not recommend to other rape victims that they report their assault to the Missoula cops. President Engstrom agreed with counsel David Aronofsky that the university did the right thing by not reporting the February 10th rape to Missoula law enforcement officials. As is required by federal law, he told Florio, the university cannot and did not release the names of alleged victims or perpetrators to police. The accuracy of the statement, however, is questionable. Federal law, Montana law, and the university's policy concerning sexual assault and the privacy of victims and perpetrators are confusing at best, and in some regards contradictory. According to the 2011 Dear Colleague letter issued by the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, as soon as a school has notice of a sexual assault, it should take immediate steps to investigate or otherwise determine what occurred and take prompt and effective steps to prevent its occurrence and, as appropriate, remedy its effects. But as Diane Barrs noted in her January 31st report to Engstrom, this is the most difficult part for the UM and other universities because the guidelines are not clear on what constitutes prompt and effective steps. In any event, on Friday evening, February 17, 2012, the university provided the Missoula police with the name of the alleged rapist, and the cops immediately began looking for him, according to Assistant Chief of Police Mike Brady. On Tuesday, February 21st, both victims went to the police department, gave statements to detectives, and confirmed their assailant's identity from photographs. It was all for naught, unfortunately. Before the day was out, the police discovered that the perpetrator had fled Missoula on February 19th and had caught a flight to Saudi Arabia. The collective anger in Missoula over the escape of the foreign rapist was searing. Less than a month after the Barrs report warned that sexual assaults on the UM campus required immediate action, the problem seemed only to be escalating. At a city council meeting on February 27, 2012, Councilman Dick Haynes ripped university administrators for not doing more to prevent the Saudi perpetrator from fleeing the country. They have to realize that person is a threat to more than just the campus, Haynes declared, adding that using federal regulations as an excuse for not immediately turning the case over to the city police was unacceptable. If in December you were showboating about how preventing sexual assaults was a top priority, Tracy Cox, spokeswoman for the Pennsylvania-based National Sexual Violence Resource Center, told Florio. And just 2 months later, this is happening. It takes your credibility down several notches. And the person fleeing, that takes it to a whole new level. Then, when the crisis seemed like it couldn't get any worse, it did. At 1:16 a.m. on March 19, 2012, Irina Cates, a reporter for the local television station KPAX, posted a story on the station's website under the headline, Grizz QB Served with Restraining Order After Alleged Sexual Assault. Cates had discovered that a female UM student had petitioned the court for protection from Jordan Johnson, the star quarterback of the football team, alleging that Johnson raped her. 3 months earlier, Johnson, a 19-year-old sophomore from Eugene, Oregon, had led the Grizzlies to first place in the Big Sky Conference with a record of 11 wins and 3 losses for the 2011 season, which ended with an impressive run at the FCS National Championship. The woman he allegedly raped, Cecilia Washburn, pseudonym, was a 20-year-old junior at the UM School of Pharmacy. They'd been friends since 2010, had dated intermittently, and engaged in a few makeout sessions, but things had never gone further than that sexually. Mostly their relationship consisted of exchanging text messages. Then, in the spring of 2011, Cecilia Washburn started dating another man, Jordan Johnson became interested in another woman, and the nascent relationship between Washburn and Johnson fizzled, as Washburn put it. In December 2011, however, after Washburn's relationship with her boyfriend ended, Johnson and Washburn started texting each other again. A lot. According to Missoula Police Detective Connie Bruckner, from December 2011 through February 4, 2012, when the rape allegedly occurred, Johnson and Washburn exchanged a few hundred texts. 75% of these exchanges were initiated by Johnson. Washburn characterized their texts as friendly and flirty during her sworn testimony. In early December 2011, after a Grizz playoff victory, Jordan Johnson went to a party, got buzzed, and texted Cecilia Washburn to ask for a ride home so he wouldn't have to drive drunk. When Washburn picked up Johnson and drove him to his house, he invited her inside for a quick tour of the residence, but they didn't even kiss. More than a year later, during Johnson's trial, his attorney asked him why he'd called Washburn that evening instead of one of his other friends. "I don't know," he replied. "I just did." "Did you kind of like her?" the lawyer asked. "Not necessarily," Johnson answered. He explained that he was more interested in Kelly Froland, the woman he'd been pursuing since early 2011. "We weren't boyfriend and girlfriend," he said, describing his relationship with Froland, "but we liked each other." "Did you like her a lot?" the attorney inquired. "Yes," said Johnson. In late December 2011, Cecilia Washburn left town to spend the university's 6-week winter break with her family, and Jordan Johnson went to Oregon to visit his family. They texted each other often during this period. During the first weekend of February 2012, by which time both of them were back in Missoula, they bumped into each other at an annual campus bacchanal known as the Foresters Ball, held on consecutive nights every winter. It was Friday night, February 3rd, 2012, the first night of the ball. Approximately 1,500 young men and women were in attendance. Although no alcohol was served at the event, most of the students had gotten sozzled before they arrived, including both Washburn and Johnson. Cecilia Washburn had come to the ball with 10 or 12 people. Jordan Johnson had come with his two closest friends, who also happened to be housemates and football teammates of his, Bo Tully and Alex Bieniemann. Early in the evening, Washburn was dancing with an acquaintance when she saw Johnson walk by. "So I went up to him," she testified. "Gave him a big hug, asked how he was doing." Johnson testified that he was happy to see her. Washburn slid her hand along the small of Johnson's back, leaned into him, and drunkenly declared, according to Johnson and Bieniemann, "Jordy, I would do you anytime." The consequences of this nonchalant, alcohol-soaked proposition, as it turned out, were much, much greater than anyone could have imagined. When the soiree came to an end, Johnson went home with Tully and Bieniemann and crawled into his bed alone. Washburn invited some of her friends to come over to her rented house, where they socialized until 2 or 3 in the morning, and then she went to bed alone as well. Despite staying up so late, Washburn roused herself at 7:30 the next morning to go to work at Missoula's Ronald McDonald House, a facility that provides support for gravely ill children and their families. She volunteered there every Saturday from 8 a.m. until 10 a.m., on Sunday mornings from 7 until 9, and all night every Monday. After her shift that Saturday morning, she went home, made pancakes for her two male housemates, and hung out with a visitor from Great Falls. Around 2 that afternoon, Washburn received a text from Johnson. "Hey, you," he wrote, initiating an exchange in which he inquired what her plans were for the evening. In the flurry of messages that followed, they arranged to watch a movie together at Washburn's house. Johnson texted her again at 10:29 p.m. and then at 10:40 to ask if she would drive over to his house and give him a ride back to her place to watch the movie, because he'd been drinking and didn't think it was prudent for him to drive. Washburn didn't reply, however, because she'd fallen asleep. Growing anxious around 10:45, Johnson phoned Washburn. Awakened, finally, by the ringtone on her phone, she answered and said she'd come right over. When Cecilia Washburn left her house to pick up Jordan Johnson, she had not showered for more than 24 hours, had not brushed her hair, had not bothered to put on clean clothes or any makeup. She had done none of the things, in short, that one might expect a young woman to do if she was hoping to have sex for the first time with a man she was pursuing. As Washburn later testified, although she was definitely attracted to Johnson and hoped to have sex with him at some point in the future, she never had any intention of having sex with him that night. She just wanted to watch a movie, maybe snuggle a little if the opportunity presented itself, and explore the possibility of rekindling some sort of relationship with him. Washburn had consumed no alcohol whatsoever since the previous night. Jordan Johnson shared a rented house with 5 other football players. According to his testimony, between the hours of 5 and 10 p.m., he was drinking beer and hanging out with Alex Bieniemy, Bo Tully, and some other Grizz teammates. During this period, he testified he probably drank no more than 4 or 5 beers, but in a statement to the Missoula police, Bieniemy's recollection was that Johnson drank 3 or 4 beers in the 45 minutes before he departed for Washburn's house, in addition to whatever he'd imbibed over the preceding 4 hours. As Johnson walked out the door, Bieniemy urged him to get her done, buddy. Johnson testified that he thought Cecilia Washburn was really nice, a smart girl. I liked her as a person. But, he added, I didn't like her as, like, a girlfriend type. Nevertheless, when Washburn arrived outside Johnson's house and he got into her car, he later said he thought it was a possibility that they would have sex that night. As they entered Washburn's house, she introduced Johnson to one of her housemates, a close friend named Stephen Green, who was playing a video game in the living room, then led Johnson into her room to watch the movie. Washburn had previously made a commitment to pick up a friend, Brian O'Day, sometime after midnight to give him a ride home from the second night of the Foresters' Ball. Because it was nearly 11, she wanted to get the movie started so they could watch as much of it as possible before O'Day called for his ride, at which point Johnson would have to go home. The room was small. Washburn's bed monopolized most of the floor space. Johnson took off his shoes and his watch and reclined on the bed. Washburn removed her boots, slid a DVD of a film called Easy A, a comedy inspired by The Scarlet Letter, into her television, and then lay next to him to watch the movie. After a few minutes, they began kissing. According to Washburn's testimony, although she enjoyed it, she told Johnson, "Let's just watch the movie," and they stopped kissing but continued to embrace. He was on his back, she was lying on her left side, with her right arm across his chest and her head on his shoulder. A couple of minutes later, Johnson turned to her, and they started making out again. I thought, okay, Washburn recalled. It seemed fine, and so it got a little heated. He tried to pull Washburn's shirt up. When she pulled it back down, he persisted in pulling it over her head, and she let him remove it. Then Washburn took off Johnson's shirt. She rolled on top of him, and they started grinding their hips against each other. She kissed and nibbled his ear, and he kissed her neck. All of which, she testified, was consensual. But then Johnson grabbed her arm and started getting really excited, which began to alarm her because she didn't want to do anything more than make out. She told him, "Let's just take a break. Let's just watch the movie." Washburn rolled off Johnson and resumed lying on her side, with her head on his shoulder. After a few more minutes of watching the movie, however, without saying anything, Johnson rolled on top of her and started kissing her more aggressively. Once again, she told him, "No, let's just watch the movie." But this time, instead of stopping, Washburn testified, he sat over her, kind of like a gorilla. And I said, "No, like, not tonight," because I figured that he was trying to have sex, and I didn't want that. By that point, however, Jordan Johnson seemed determined to have intercourse, despite Cecilia Washburn's repeated protestations. She was 5 feet 8 inches tall and weighed 127 pounds. He was a powerfully built football player who weighed about 200 pounds and spent a lot of time lifting in the Grizz weight room. Johnson pinned her down by placing his left arm across her shoulder and chest, she testified, and then he took my leggings and my underwear off with his right hand, and he pulled them down, and they caught around my ankles. As he was tugging her clothing off, she continued to protest, "No, not tonight." She also tried to hold her legs together, and she raised her knees against his hips in an attempt to push him away. As Washburn resisted Johnson's advances, she testified, "He didn't say anything. He was just... he changed into a totally different person. I was terrified." After Jordan Johnson pulled off Cecilia Washburn's leggings and underwear and was pinning her down with his forearm across her sternum, he commanded her to turn over onto her stomach. When she refused, Washburn testified, he said, "Turn over or I'll make you." And then at that point he grabbed my hips and flipped me over. When this happened, she said, "I just knew I was going to get raped." Once Johnson had Washburn lying face down on the bed, he forced her legs apart with his knees, placed his hand on the side of her head to hold her down, and used his other hand to unbuckle his belt and lower his jeans. "You said you wanted it," he told her. He pulled Washburn's hips up toward him so that she was on her knees with her buttocks raised in the air, and penetrated her vagina with his penis as he kneeled on the bed behind her. As he did these things, according to Washburn, he again said, "You said you wanted it. You said you wanted it." He grabbed onto my hips, and he started pulling my body into his, Washburn testified. Repeated times, just again and again and again. It hurt so bad. He penetrated her in this manner for a couple of minutes until he felt that he was about to ejaculate, at which point he withdrew his penis and came in his hand and on Washburn's blanket. When Johnson began raping her, Washburn testified, she was in complete shock. It was like I was hit with a baseball bat. I had no idea what was going on. I had never in a million years would have thought that this would have happened. And then, gradually, as things started to progress, I just slowly started to shut down. And afterwards, I was still in shock. I didn't want to believe that it happened. It was like this nightmare. After Johnson withdrew his penis from Washburn's vagina and ejaculated, she scrambled off the bed, stood beside her dresser, and stared at him, shaking, while he wiped the semen from her blanket, picked up his clothes, and walked into an adjacent bathroom. As soon as Johnson was out of her bedroom, Washburn pulled on her clothes, picked up her phone from the nightstand, and texted her housemate, Stephen Green, who was still playing a video game in the living room a few feet away. "OMG," she typed. "I think I might have just gotten raped. He kept pushing and pushing, and I said no, but he wouldn't listen. I just want to cry. OMG, what do I do?" Cecilia Washburn grabbed her purse and her wallet, put on a down vest, and walked through the living room past Green and into the kitchen, where she noticed that her friend Brian O'Day had sent her a text to ask if she would pick him up downtown and give him a ride home, as she had earlier agreed to do. Washburn replied with a text that said yes, followed by a smiley face emoticon. Later, when Washburn was asked why she responded with a smiley face, she explained that she didn't want to let O'Day know she had been raped. After replying to O'Day's text, Washburn continued out the back door and walked to her car, taking for granted that Johnson would follow her when he realized she had left. "I wanted him out of my house as quickly as possible," she testified. In her state of shock and disbelief following the rape, she decided that driving him back to his house was the most expedient way to accomplish that. As Washburn had walked past Stephen Green, he'd seen that she had tears in her eyes. "She looked really distressed," Green testified, "and she just kind of shook her head and said she didn't want to talk about it right then." Jordan Johnson came out of the house a couple of minutes after Washburn and got into the front passenger seat of her car. During the short drive to his residence, they didn't speak to each other. "No words were exchanged," Washburn testified. "Completely silent. I had tears in my eyes, but I wasn't sobbing. When I dropped him off, he got out of the car and he said, 'Well, thanks,' and then he shut the door. I turned my car around, started to cry, and then I drove home." Later, many people were baffled by Cecilia Washburn's actions during the alleged assault and immediately thereafter. When the assault began, skeptics wondered, why didn't she scream for help from Stephen Green, who was sitting just outside the door to her bedroom? And why would Washburn give Jordan Johnson a ride home after he'd raped her? There are several plausible explanations, according to Rebecca Rowe. An accomplished Seattle lawyer, Rowe worked from 1977 through 1994 in the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, where she ran the Special Assault Unit for 11 years. And in 2008, after going into private practice, she was recognized as Lawyer of the Year by the Washington State Trial Lawyers Association. Being raped is such a traumatic experience, Roe explained to me, that it often results in seemingly bizarre behavior. Fear could certainly account for Cecilia Washburn's unexpected actions, she said, but so could something as mundane as culturalization. It was actually pretty common for women not to scream or call the cops in rape cases I prosecuted, Roe said, at least partly because women aren't wired to react that way. We're socialized to be likable and not to create friction. We're brought up to be nice. Women are supposed to resolve problems without making a scene, to make bad things go away, as if they never happened. When Cecilia Washburn arrived back at her house after driving Jordan Johnson home, she walked in through the kitchen door, broke down, and started sobbing so hard she had trouble breathing. "I thought I was going to collapse," she said, "so I grabbed onto the oven door handle." As soon as Stephen Green heard Washburn's wrenching sobs, he ran into the kitchen to comfort her, then persuaded her to sit down with him in the living room. "I sat on his lap, and he just sat there rubbing my back," Washburn recalled. After Washburn talked to Green for about 20 minutes, she took a long shower. She said she felt filthy and violated and wanted to get clean and just scrub every crevice of my body. Chapter 12. By the time Cecilia Washburn finished showering, it was approximately 1 a.m. Her friend Brian O'Day still needed a ride home, so she put on her clothes, got back in her car, and drove downtown to pick him up. When O'Day got in the car, he noticed that she looked upset, so he asked what was wrong. Washburn burst into tears and told him she'd been raped. By the time she returned to her house and went to bed, it was 2:30 a.m. After waking up on Sunday morning, February 5th, 2012, Cecilia Washburn texted a close friend, Allie Bierer, to tell her what had happened the night before. Bierer, a senior at the UM Pharmacy School, was a year older than Washburn. During her freshman and sophomore years, Bierer had worked 20 hours a week as a resident assistant, a job that entailed providing advice and support to students. As part of her training for the position, she'd been instructed how to respond to students who came to her to report sexual assaults. Guided by this training, Bierer urged Washburn to go immediately to the First Step Resource Center. This is the same clinic for sexual assault victims where Allison Huguette was taken by her mother after being raped by Bo Donaldson, and where Kelsey Belknap was taken after allegedly being gang-raped by four teammates of Donaldson's and Jordan Johnson's. Bierer offered to drive Washburn to First Step. Washburn was skeptical, but she relented to Bierer's urging because she wanted to be treated for her genital injuries and for potential sexually transmitted diseases. "I just wanted to make sure that I was physically okay," Washburn testified. When Bierer picked Washburn up to take her to the clinic, Washburn's appearance worried her. "She was very frazzled, withdrawn," Bierer testified. "She wasn't looking at me. She was crying, just very shaken." At First Step, Cecilia Washburn met with Claire Francoeur, the nurse practitioner on duty. Francoeur explained that Washburn was not required to report the alleged rape to the police, but noted that if there was any possibility that she might decide to report the assault at some future date, it was very important that she receive a forensic medical exam right away, in order for evidence to be collected. Washburn consented to the exam, which turned out to be so painful that she asked Francoeur to stop in the middle of it for a little while. The exam determined that Washburn had genital pain, in addition to mild redness, swelling, and some small abrasions, marks on her chest, and tenderness to the side of her head. After the exam, Washburn was ambivalent about whether to report the rape to the authorities. She had four options. She could go to the Missoula police and seek redress through the criminal justice system. She could report the assault to the University of Montana. She could file reports with both the police and the university, or she could remain silent. None of these choices was appealing. Each had the potential to affect her life in unpredictable and adverse ways. After weighing possible risks against possible benefits, Washburn decided to forego filing a police report, at least for the time being, but to report to the University of Montana that she had been raped by Jordan Johnson. She hoped that by not filing a formal report with the Missoula Police Department, she would be able to keep the rape confidential and out of the media. A few days after visiting First Step, she gave a statement to UM Dean Charles Couture. He immediately launched a formal investigation. On Sunday, February 12th, Jordan Johnson arrived home from a trip to Pullman, Washington, to find a letter from Couture on official University of Montana stationery. "Dear Mr. Johnson," the missive began, "I have initiated an investigation into the allegation that you have violated